Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Lessons with Leaders, a special edition of Lehigh Valley Discourse. I am your host, Lori Siebert. Our producer tonight is Neil Heaver. Our guest is Adrian Shanker, founder and executive director of Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center, an award-winning activist and organizer whose career has centered on advancing progress for the LGBT community. He has worked as an arts fundraiser, labor organizer, marketing manager, and served as president of Equality Pennsylvania for 3 years before founding Bradbury Sullivan Center, Allentown, Pennsylvania's LGBT community center, where he serves as executive director. An accomplished organizer, Adrian has led numerous successful campaigns to advance LGBT progress through municipal non-discrimination and relationship recognition laws and laws to protect LGBT youth from conversion therapy. A specialist in LGBT health policy, he has developed leading-edge health promotion campaigns to advance health equity through behavioral, clinical, and policy changes. Adrian administered data collection for the 2015 and 2018 Pennsylvania LGBT Health Needs Assessments. He is editor of the forthcoming book, Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health, which will be released in early 2020 by PM Press. Adrian also serves in two capacities in Governor Tom Wolf's administration as a commissioner on both the Pennsylvania Commission on LGBTQ Affairs and the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission. He also serves as a board member for the Nonprofit and Business Partners Council at the Lehigh Valley Chamber and as a member of the ANIZDA Board, the Allentown Neighborhood Improvement Zone Development Association. He has received many awards for his work, including that earlier this year, Lehigh Valley Business named him a healthcare hero, and he has twice been named Person of the Year by Philadelphia Gay News. Welcome, Adrian.
It's so great to be here, Lori.
Yeah, thank you for coming. I'm so glad that we're going to have this opportunity to talk tonight. Reading your bio, I get the impression that you are someone who does not wait for someone else to do the heavy lifting. I am curious to learn more about what drives that. Do you mind sharing a bit about your family and growing up? That's always one of my first questions I like to ask my leaders, and that is, where are you in the lineup of your family?
Well, I was raised by an activist family. My grandfather was a national union leader, Albert Shanker. He led the American Federation of Teachers for a few decades, including through some major teachers union strikes in New York City. And growing up, we learned about the importance of being activists for things we believed in. Bedtime stories as a kid were about, you know, my grandfather spending Christmas in jail for leading the teachers union out on strike. It's always been very important to my family that they taught me how to be an activist. And that's something that I take very seriously with my own work today.
What a tribute to your parents and your grandparents then, too, that you took on that role as well. They must be very proud of you.
I'd like to think so.
Okay. And where are you in the family? Are you an only child? Are there siblings?
I have two siblings, okay. Both younger.
So you are the oldest?
Yes.
Okay. Sorry, that is a common theme. So those stories were very important to you, and we're so glad. Now, were you also an activist at a young age, or did that seem to come out more as you got into college?
I became an activist in high school, and I was always very passionate about a number of issues, but the issue that's always risen to the top for me is the lack of equity that our society has given for the LGBT community. I was raised by lesbian moms, and from an early age, I remember that, you know, when my parents got divorced, my dad was able to get remarried and my mom couldn't. And so I was able to see inequity very clearly. In high school, I became an activist, and it's also when I realized my own identity. And, you know, I've always just been very passionate about working for LGBT equality in different ways. And that's looked different over time. For many years, my passion was focused on things like marriage equality and non-discrimination. And to be sure, incredibly important issues. The fight for marriage in Pennsylvania was major. And it's not been that long since we've won. And it feels like it was ages ago because of how far our society has come. But even with those really major wins, my work has shifted to focus on health equity for the LGBT community. And I wasn't always passionate about health equity. I didn't understand what health equity meant until somewhat recently. I remember back to the 2008 presidential campaign when, much like today, every presidential debate centered on healthcare reform. And honestly, I didn't understand the issue well enough to be passionate about it. I was privileged with access to healthcare, being on my mom's insurance and being relatively healthy. I had seen the same doctor my entire life. I was pretty sure that, you know, if there was a bigoted healthcare provider out there, they would surely have a sign on their door to let us all know. and I had never experienced healthcare discrimination or negative experiences with doctors. And as I've gotten older, I've realized that that was an enormous privilege to have not had those negative experiences earlier, and that the lack of health equity in our country for the LGBT community and more broadly as well is one of the biggest issues facing our historically underserved and marginalized populations. And it has to be central to our work today.
And I know we're going to talk about the impact of that need that you saw going through the rest of the program this evening as well to raise awareness about that. So I think that's really important. I think it's also interesting with your background and your family, how lucky, not just privilege with the healthcare that you mentioned, but privilege in being in an environment of activism and equality all the way around with your mothers and yourself. So that's really interesting. Sometimes we land in a place that's safe, and we'll see, and we can talk about, not everybody does land in a safe place, and that's why they need activists to be their voice.
Most LGBT people are raised without cultural context, without people in our families who share our identities. And I was privileged to grow up in a family that that gave me an understanding of my own community. But that's not common for most LGBT people. So for many of us, like when we're dealing with whether it's health challenges or legal challenges, they're often new to us. It's the first time we've thought about it. And that's something we see at Bradbury Sullivan Center all the time, are people coming in saying, I didn't know that this would be an issue, and now I'm struggling with this.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned legal issues as well. You graduated with a BA in political science and religion studies from Muhlenberg College in Allentown. So first, I was wondering, how much did attending a liberal arts college impact your activism as well? Now, you said you started in high school, but quite often we get our wings in college. So I was really curious to see how much that might have impacted you, if at all.
I got a wonderful education at Muhlenberg College, and as a double major in political science and religion studies at a liberal arts school, I really enjoyed learning about different issues from so many different lenses. And I do take that into my activism when I think about, well, what does it mean to be an activist and bring history into our activism and bring society into our activism? We can't today be an activist for any social movement and not understand the role that religion plays in our society, or the role that politics plays in our society, or the role that economics plays in our society, or so many other lenses in which our society operates. To be a good activist really requires kind of a diverse understanding of the world as it is, so that we can make the world as we wish it to be.
We need to quote everything you just said. That was really a great take on that. I was even writing notes. I love the history and society into our activism. And then that liberal arts education helps give you that broad lens to kind of drill down and bring the world to where we want to
be. I'll give a brief example. If we want to talk about LGBT health activism today, we have to understand that there was a time not too long ago when LGBT people needed to become their own healthcare activists, when an entire generation of people who look like me died from what we now know is a treatable chronic condition. And we LGBT people needed to become experts in their own healthcare needs, experts in their own bodies, experts in their political movements to be able to change systems that did not want to move. And for LGBT health activists today, we have to understand that history of healthcare activism, the history of HIV/AIDS in America, but also the history of the political movements, the radical movements that literally acted up to make change. It's impossible to fight for health equity today without that lens.
Well, and without that kind of legal view as well. So we might have thought with the political science major that you might have pursued law, but you've continued to talk about legal protections in your work, whether it's LGBTQ issues or the healthcare issues that you're seeing have to be navigated, which could raise the element of legal issues about providing equitable healthcare. So you've navigated quite a bit of that through your all these different, you were in labor, all these different positions that you've had. So how has that felt? That did the political science degree help, or was it again the activism that you were raised with that brought kind of that legal aspect to all of this that you're working on?
I think when you go to a liberal arts college, you get a little bit of everything. And that's what I really liked about going to Muhlenberg, was learning how to think from lots of different lenses. But for me, I'm just very grateful that there are wonderful lawyers out there to be the legal experts that our society needs. And in the LGBT movement, we have some profoundly amazing lawyers in our national movement whose legal work has moved our community forward in so many ways. That's not the role that I see for myself. For myself, I see my own activism centering around community-based organizing, around building community structures like our community center, where we can have community ownership of our queer spaces. I see my work as an LGBT health activist as developing expertise to retrain the next generation, the current generation of healthcare providers, and also train the next generation, because healthcare is not working for LGBT bodies. LGBT people are not experiencing a high quality of health in America, and I see my role as an activist, as someone that can make change from a different way than through courts, for example, or through other legal structures.
So that's interesting, because I was imagining that quite a bit of what you might have been doing was around the legal side, and you're really saying, no, that's not the case.
Yeah, a lot of the challenges are certainly legal, but some of the challenges are social. And by the way, none of the challenges are biological. So when we look at LGBT health disparities, it's not that LGBT people are genetically more predisposed to things like, cancer or substance abuse. It's that these are social problems that lead people to have higher risk factors, lower screening rates, these are social challenges. They're not legal challenges. They're very much a lack of training. They're a lack of interest or a lack of knowledge about LGBT health. It's based on societal assumptions about who we are, as opposed to simply asking us about the kind of care that we need.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk more about that too when we talk about the book. We've used the words activism quite a bit already in our talk with you this evening. With all your roles, I kind of was getting the feeling of impact, like Adrian must have some inherent need to have impact. It could be called activism, but so how would you describe from, your leadership, what is it that's driving you? Is it this need for what we might call activism or to have an impact? Is it, as you mentioned earlier, this need for equity in whatever form it might be? What is it that's driving you? If I'm listening to the show and see you as a leader in our community and young people looking up to you and watching you, what is it that's really driving you?
I'm driven to do this work because the world that I was born into, the world that we were all born into, just isn't equitable. And it's wrong, and we're here to be able to make the changes that we believe in, And for me, as an activist, as an organizer, that's always been the driving force, is how do we make the Lehigh Valley, how do we make Pennsylvania, how do we make our country and our world more equitable for LGBT people? The type of activism I'm interested in is a type of activism that leads to change, the type of activism that advances progress for the LGBT community. I'm less interested in activism that that makes noise, but that might not make change. Noise is sometimes helpful, but I'm really interested in seeing ways that we can advance progress to make the lived experiences of LGBT people in our communities more equitable.
Don't you feel like sometimes it's awareness? I mean, that sounds so simple, and I'm not sure if I'm explaining myself enough, that, you know, you can meet people and they might have a preconceived notion. Maybe it's their own prejudice without being informed, without knowledge. So do you have anything at the community center that helps people who may be struggling with understanding this community?
Yeah.
Do you have programs
Absolutely. Well, first off, Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center provides a variety of programs for the community. All of our programs are offered for free without regard to people's ability to pay. So we provide arts, health, youth, and pride programs for the Lehigh Valley's LGBT community, and we're so proud to do so. Our arts programs are great ways for all people in the community to get to know who we are, to celebrate the LGBT community's tradition of arts and culture through literature, visual art, film, and as well as art history, and to be able to learn and engage and celebrate together. We also offer supportive services and youth programs that are for our community especially. And we have a training institute, which is led by Liz Bradbury, a member of our team, who goes out and trains law enforcement, healthcare professionals, educators, social service, and older adult professionals to help make sure that the experiences that LGBT people have outside of our building are as equitable as possible, as appropriate as possible, that well-intentioned people that work elsewhere in the Lehigh Valley are also able to provide high-quality, appropriate, culturally appropriate services for the LGBT population here. And that's a big piece of our work.
And is the community receptive to that as far as like what Liz is doing?
Yeah, overwhelmingly, most people want to provide good services for the LGBT community. It's what we call the bigoted few, and we're not trying to persuade them with our trainings. We are trying to train people who want to do the right thing, but they might not know how. They might not know the right language. They might not know the cultural history or the experiences, but they want to do the right thing. They're the middle that can be moved, and that's the majority of people who work in healthcare or education, social services, et cetera. So a big piece of our work is trying to engage people that are very receptive. They might just not have the language or the tools at their disposal already.
Okay, that's wonderful to know that's available. Folks, we are talking with Adrian Schenker, founder and executive director of Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center. And you are listening to Lessons with Leaders. We'll be back in a moment.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails. Discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100, extension 7, or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
This is your host, Lori Siebert, and I am continuing my conversation with Adrian Schenker, founder and executive director of Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center. We've learned from Adrian that he was a natural-born activist, being raised in a community of people around him that were also very active in advancing the equity amongst people. And he continued that into his high school years, his college years, and now his ongoing roles as a professional and as executive director of Bradbury Sullivan Center. So we thank him for being here and talking about this, because personally, I think you have to be very brave to be an activist. You wouldn't think we'd have to be. We wouldn't think that it should be something that we should hold out to wish for equity for everybody, but sometimes that is what it comes to. So we really appreciate you coming here and sharing your story and sharing your story in the community as well. We've talked about a number of things, and one thing that is obvious is that you are very passionate about health equity, and that you have taken on this as your current real role in advancing health equity. Could you explain what that is a little bit before we go on?
Yeah, well, the U.S. government defines health equity in their document, Healthy People 2020, as the attainment of the highest quality of health for all people, not just some people, not just heterosexual people or white people or middle-aged people, all people. All people deserve health equity. And it is something that's deserved. It's something that we should demand and expect, that the treatment that we receive from care professionals should be equitable, that the access to healthcare should be equitable, that even the healthcare outcomes should be equitable. But we know that they're not. We know that this is just not a goal that's achieved in America today. For LGBT people specifically, we have so many social and cultural challenges that lead us to higher risk behaviors. At the same time, we know that only 1 in 5 LGBT Pennsylvanians has someone that they consider to be their personal doctor, which means that they're less likely to get cancer screenings, less likely to get preventative care in general. When we don't get preventative care, we end up with worse off health outcomes as a community. And we know that LGBT lives are shortened by preventable and treatable issues. And that is the lack of health equity in the world today, where LGBT people experience pervasive health disparities affecting every part of our body and every part of our job, every part of our lives. And it's our job as activists to raise awareness about this and also make change, training healthcare professionals, educating each other within our own community and the broader society, so that we can work towards the dream of health equity in our society.
And everyone else will benefit from that as well, because I'm sure there are segments of the population, even outside of the LGBTQ community, that also are experiencing some inequity in their healthcare, whether it's rural,
A rising tide raises all boats.
There you go.
When we work to advance access to care for LGBT people, we're also improving access to care for women. We're also improving access to care in rural communities and in lower income urban communities. We're achieving better health care for all of us at the same time.
Thank you, Adrian. I wanted to refer to an article that I read in the New York Times just recently by Paula Kodaki. And bear with me, because it's a little bit of a long intro for this. But the article was called Hope and High Drama, which highlighted Ayanna Pressley, a first-year member of the House of Representatives and first African-American woman to win a seat in Congress from Massachusetts. Congresswoman Pressley quoted author Zora Neale Hurston in saying, "There is no agony like bearing an untold story inside you." And then she added, "I think that's true, but I think there's an even worse agony, and it's to be misunderstood. I can't help but think," end quote. So I can't help but think that you might have been faced with that in your journey as well with your community. So does any of that ring true with you personally or professionally?
I think that historically the LGBT community has certainly been misunderstood at different points and in different ways throughout the last century, to be sure, and even more recently. You know, the fight for marriage equality was certainly an example of a society misunderstanding the LGBT community, the experiences many transgender people have, even accessing, you know, basic life functions like public restrooms, is an example of society misunderstanding our community when people try to fight against what seems so basic to us, the right to get married, the right to use a public facility, and other people are vitriolic in their response. That's an example of those other people strongly misunderstanding us. When it comes to healthcare, I mean, many of us have had negative experiences with healthcare professionals, even well-intentioned ones. And in my own life, I went to see a dermatologist about a year ago for a baseline screening. And from every step of the way, the minute I walked in until the minute I left, I felt like the clinic staff, who I'm sure were believing strongly that they were providing equitable care for everyone, I felt from the minute I walked in until the minute I left that they weren't providing care for people like me. And that's a very common experience for LGBT people today, that the world around us, the healthcare services we can access, the social services we can access, were just not designed for people like us. There's a 14-year-old program participant at Whitman Walker Health, which is the LGBT health clinic in DC, and they have a youth program where this this student was involved. And he said that wellness is about surviving in a world that wasn't made for you. Wellness is about surviving in a world that wasn't made for you. And for me, that just rings so true in what it means to be misunderstood. When we're misunderstood, it means that we're not given equitable treatment. We're not given equitable treatment, it means that our wellness is not achieved either. Similarly, HIV activist Sean Stroob, who actually has a chapter in my book as well, Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health. Sean Stroob says that stigma is about other people making a judgment about your worth. And that's really what it comes down to, is wellness versus stigma. We want to be treated with equity. We want to access wellness. But instead, we're frequently stigmatized for things that just seem so normative in our lives today for who we are.
Well, I guess, too, you know, I wonder if some of it comes from that you're already kind of growing up with a little bit of a stigma, you know, whether it's something you've learned from other people's behaviors or watching other people react to you. So what maybe healthcare professionals encounter or other people is they don't realize that you may be coming into a situation where you're feeling like that, because they don't know, they don't understand your situation, so they don't know what it means to feel safe. Because you could have patients in a healthcare environment who are coming in already not feeling safe. So is that part of your activism in some of the training that Bradbury Sullivan Center goes out to do in the healthcare community, where they're talking to, whether it's healthcare providers or even businesses, to say what that looks like or what that feels like, so that you don't feel like you're not getting the same kind of service and care?
Absolutely. First, just some data. So in Pennsylvania, according to our 2018 LGBT health needs assessment for our state, we learned that over 50% of lesbian, gay, and bisexual Pennsylvanians and over 75% of transgender Pennsylvanians fear going to see a healthcare professional because of a negative past experience that they've had. That's a tremendously scary number of people that fear seeking any healthcare as a result of those negative experiences. So when we're working with care professionals, we're trying to provide stories about the kinds of negative past experiences that people have had, and then provide promising practices about how clinics that want to provide high quality care can do so. What does it mean to have an LGBT affirming waiting room or intake process? What does it mean for an actual clinician to be knowledgeable about our bodies and our lives? Because sometimes the things about us that are unique to who we are different. And the kind of care that we need is slightly different. What does it mean to have specialists who understand the uniqueness about our lives? who can speak to us without judgment, without stigma, and without without putting shame on us, who can just ask us the questions that need to be asked and provide the care and medical advice that they need to provide. So frequently, this is not the case in healthcare in this country. Our healthcare system is broken for LGBT people, and it's our job to try to fix it. It shouldn't be our job. It should be the job of the healthcare system. But as activists, it is our job, because if we don't do this work, it won't happen.
You know, my husband had worked at a former employer who provided, I think it was triangles that they could put on their door to show that this was a safe space, so that people in the LGBTQ community could feel comfortable that if they had something to share or talk about or needed to maybe just vent about maybe something that was happening in their life from a personal perspective, you see people having water cooler conversations, and they might be talking about their escapades from the night before, but someone who might be gay might not feel comfortable going and having that conversation if they don't feel it's a safe space. So they had this symbol, and I thought that was really worthwhile.
And there's examples of that throughout the Lehigh Valley. We have a pediatric clinic in this area who many of the clinicians wear rainbow ribbons on their name badges to let the teenagers that they serve know that they're a safe person to ask questions to. It's just a quick symbol, but for an LGBT teenager, they're going to know exactly what that means and feel confident and comfortable asking that kind of question. That's one way, one of many ways that clinicians can do a good job.
But they could also go through some of the training. Does the Bradbury Sullivan Center provide training to healthcare professionals?
Are
you to that point?
Yes, we do.
Where you can talk about what that
intake. We don't provide clinical training.
Right.
We provide training on how to serve the LGBT patient population effectively.
Okay, wonderful. Bradbury Sullivan Center, along with other various civil rights groups, was a plaintiff in the proposed denial of care rule by the Trump administration, which was subsequently vacated by Judge William Alsup. And being part of that, I know your organization was very happy. How did that win feel for you?
Well, first, we had never sued the Trump administration or the federal government ever before. We didn't quite know how to go about suing the federal government until we did it. But it was incredibly important because this proposed rule from the Trump administration was scary, problematic, and would have been detrimental to the lives of LGBT people across our country and here in the Lehigh Valley. We defended our community by representing the constituents that we serve in challenging this blatantly unconstitutional rule that would have invited healthcare professionals to decide who they want to serve as their patients and to decide that they don't serve people like me or people like you. And this especially would have affected women, transgender people, people living with HIV, LGBT people seeking fertility treatment, people seeking preventative HIV medicine. And the definition of healthcare that the Trump administration proposed was anybody working in the service of healthcare. They actually specifically wrote that included receptionists working at medical facilities that could say that they won't process somebody's intake form, a janitor or housekeeping staff that wouldn't prepare a room or clean up a room before or after a procedure. The challenges this would have placed on healthcare employers was problematic, but worse than that is the effect on the lived experiences of LGBT patients. Without our health, we don't have our lives, and it was so important to stand up against this blatantly problematic rule. And we're very pleased that the court ruled in our favor and vacated the rule in its entirety because it was such a problematic rule for LGBT health.
Yeah.
It was also the third court to strike down this rule. Three courts have now ruled in the same way that this rule violates the constitutional rights of LGBT people.
And what's interesting is this healthcare equity continues even despite, you know, getting that rule vacated. That would have gone completely backwards as well. So it's already, your community is already feeling an inequality in the healthcare provided, and this would have just thrown it all into complete turmoil.
This rule would have worsened health disparities, made care harder to access, especially in rural communities. It would have made it so that LGBT people would have a greater fear than they already do about seeking care. And frankly, it would have put a tremendous burden on healthcare employers that might have limited the care that they're able to offer for our community as well.
So your next big endeavor is this book, Bodies and Barriers. You've mentioned Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health, to be published in the spring. And I just want to read a little intro or comment from one of the people who must have been able to read it ahead of time, Sarah Hexam Hubbard Esquire, executive director of the National Nurse-Led Care Consortium, said, "In Bodies and Barriers, Adrian Shanker makes the case for culturally responsive care that meets the needs for the LGBT community through compelling essays by LGBT healthcare consumers. This book enables nurses and all healthcare professionals to understand the challenges of LGBT clients, families, and communities, and is a call to action for everyone involved in patient care to truly listen and learn." Now, we have a couple minutes before our next break, and I want to talk more about the book, but your first take on how important is this to you, and why now?
I've never written a book before, and this was a big project to curate a conversation about LGBT health. And that's really what my role as an editor is in this book, is to bring together essays by 26 activists around the world who are fighting for health equity for the LGBT population in the communities where they live and serve. But these essays are activist essays. They're first-person narratives about the care that we've received. And the book is arranged chronologically to follow the life of an LGBT community from birth through death. One of the first chapters is by Elisa Bowman from Emmaus, who writes about navigating pediatric care for transgender youth. She's the parent of a transgender kid who has had to navigate pediatric care in that way. One of the last chapters in the book is about older adult needs, including bereavement services. And Justin Tanis writes a chapter about bereavement support for LGBT people. So this book follows birth through death, the life of LGBT people, and it's really the first book to present healthcare consumer narratives from the LGBT community with a special intent of informing and improving the healthcare system in America.
And that goes back to the being understood, I think, that we talked about a little bit earlier, and that in reading this book, hopefully we're going to get a little bit more understanding, or healthcare professionals can have a little bit of a better understanding. So I want to go through some of those other stories when we come back from our next break. You are listening to Lessons with Leaders, and our special guest, Adrian Shanker, founder and executive director of Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center. We'll be back in just a minute.
Spread the word about your business or organization to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR news and locally produced programs reaches thousands of engaged listeners in the Lehigh Valley and beyond. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable and effective way to provide information about your product and services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, 610-694-8100, extension 6, or WDIY.org.
Welcome back to Lessons with Leaders. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and with my guest this evening, Adrian Shanker, founder and executive director of Bradbury Sullivan LGBT Community Center. We were discussing, Adrian, your new book, Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health, which is to be published in the spring. And this all goes to the theme tonight in our conversation about health equity. Can you tell us a little bit more about the book? You had mentioned that it's chronological, which I think is, you know, a really good idea to start young and then into the later years through the whole cycle of healthcare needs that one might have through different aspects of their life. With the book, where did that idea come from? And what was the timeline? Like, how long have you been working on this again?
I worked on this book for 2 years, from start to publication. And it's a journey to put a book together. The book started because of two reasons. One, when I was a graduate student at the George Washington University in their LGBT health policy and practice program, I was really struck by the lack of literature available written by LGBT people about our healthcare experiences for the healthcare professions. And there was so much literature that was written about LGBT healthcare by researchers about us. And to be sure, there's more that's needed. But there was a big gap in the literature that I wanted to address. And the second was my own experience seeking dermatological care and feeling like I couldn't receive equitable care in the Lehigh Valley. In fact, I go to a dermatologist near Philadelphia as a result of a negative past experience here. And as a full-time queer activist who is very out in my life and is engaged as a leader in many ways, I have no hesitation in speaking up when I experience mistreatment from a healthcare provider. But in that moment, I didn't even want to go back for a follow-up test. I just wanted to find somebody else. And I think that's a very common experience. This book is about elevating the voices of many leaders, some well-known around the world and some who are emerging leaders in their own communities. And it's about telling their stories authentically with their own voices. It's about Catherine Dalk, who writes about informed consent for intersex children. And as an intersex woman, she talks about what she wishes she could have said to her parents when she was very little. And she says, "Teach me about my body and I'll teach you about myself." Mm. It's about Sean Stroop, who writes about challenging HIV stigma. And Sean talks about how in the early days of the HIV epidemic, people who were not HIV positive would sort of pity or feel bad for people living with HIV. And today, in an era when treatment is available, Sean says that the stigma is worse than it was in those early days, because instead of feeling a sense of pity, people feel a sense of that a person has made bad choices. And they critique the choices people have made and stigmatize people in a very different way. In some ways, Sean argues a more harmful way. In Imani Woody's chapter about housing and healthcare, she speaks about how hard it is for LGBT older adults to find affirming and affordable housing opportunities, and that in the United States today, there isn't a single continuum of care housing option for LGBT older adults where people can age in a way that allows them to get progressive care as they need it. Liz Bradbury from the center also writes a chapter where she talks about how the aging in place model just doesn't work for LGBT people because it relies on assumptions that don't exist in many LGBT families. There are so many important stories from across our country and two that are from outside the U.S. And these stories need to be heard. And that's what I was trying to do as the editor of this book, was to kind of put it all together so that when healthcare professionals ask me, what can I do different? I could say, you can read these stories and learn to provide care that's responsive to our culture and our needs. And, you know, these stories are not stories of 30 years ago. They're stories of today. You know, we hear stories all the time at Bradbury Sullivan Center from people who come in seeking services because the care that they've received in other settings is just not okay.
And there's not been a book out of this nature?
Not a book written by LGBT people, mm-hmm. sharing our specific narratives of our healthcare experiences with the intention of informing healthcare professionals to provide better care.
Mm-hmm. So would this book be for healthcare professionals singularly, or broader spectrum?
Well, the book is for everyone. It's written, it's not a scholarly text, it's not academic. It's written in everyday language that all of us can learn from. there is a special intention that healthcare professionals, students in health professions, and policymakers will take this as an opportunity to hear the stories from their LGBT patients or constituents, because every person involved in making policy for public or private entities, whether they work for a health network, an insurance company, or the government, is making policies that impact the health of LGBT people. And every healthcare professional, whether they work as a nurse or a physician or a social worker or counselor, is providing care for LGBT people, whether that's listed as one of their specialties or not.
Well, this could be an empowerment for people in the LGBT community as well, that if they have had these experiences and they know about this book and have read it themselves and realize these stories could be told to make a difference, they too then might share their own story with the entities where they're going for care. And that might make the difference.
Absolutely. And that's really what leadership is about. Leadership is about stepping up and speaking out. And in this instance, when we're talking about LGBT people who've had negative experiences with healthcare professionals, it's about telling our stories. And telling our stories can make us vulnerable. It can be hard. It can be very challenging, and it can feel like we're re-traumatizing in some ways with these very challenging experiences. Leadership is about saying there's other people in our community that are also having these negative experiences. We need to speak up about this social challenge in our community, which is the lack of health equity for LGBT people in America today. And the 26 contributing authors in this book all do that. They all speak up, they speak loudly, they speak clearly, they tell their stories, and they're demanding that the healthcare system does a better job of serving our bodies and our lives, because we deserve it. We deserve high quality healthcare, just like everyone else does.
And you had a foreword done by Rachel L. Levine, MD, who's the Secretary of Health for the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania and Professor of Pediatrics and Psychiatry at the Pennsylvania State College of Medicine. And that foreword was quite moving as well. And she has her own story to tell and was really probably the perfect person to write the foreword for this book.
Secretary Levine is a strong champion of LGBT healthcare, and she's seen it from three angles: as a transgender woman, as a physician who has provided care for the LGBT community, especially for LGBT adolescents, and as the top public health official for the state of Pennsylvania, where she makes policy within the context of the Wolf administration. That impacts the health of all Pennsylvanians, whether she's dealing with opioids or medical marijuana or HIV care or her declaration of hepatitis A as an outbreak in Pennsylvania. She's making policy that impacts LGBT people. So inviting her to write the foreword was asking her to think from all three of these lenses. As a patient who has experienced both good and bad care as a transgender person, as a physician who has seen the needs from the patients who came to her for care and their families, and as a policymaker who takes her responsibility very seriously in providing equitable policies that lead to equitable care for all Pennsylvanians, she was really the perfect person to write the foreword.
When we talk about leadership, and you had mentioned it's about speaking out and kind of coming forward, there was a piece in your introduction to the book where you talk about kind of surviving and persevering through what I'll call just a lot of roadblocks. So can you talk about that as well?
Absolutely.
What that means to survive.
For LGBT people, our history of navigating the healthcare system that was created by other people to serve the majority population means that we've survived as a community through a lot. We've survived through conversion therapy. We've survived through AIDS in America. We've survived through substance use and abuse. We've survived through many things. And to be sure, not all of us have survived. And survival is a privilege. Those of us who are white, who have more economic means, who have access to health insurance, have historically been more likely to survive. Those of us with family support, those of us who have higher education, have been in a better position to survive through these challenges as a society. Surviving is about thriving in healthcare. And the lack of survival is also a reality that health inequity leads to, that we lose too many LGBT lives to violence and suicide every year. That in this year already, in 2019, there's been more than 23 transgender women of color murdered. There's been countless suicides and deaths caused by substance overdose. And we've had trauma as a community from so many different things. So really what we know works is that when healthcare works for us, when we can access quality care, we can thrive, and that improves our chances of simply surviving.
You said something earlier about choices, and that people might judge and think people, you know, you might not be making good choices, or your choices lead you to this. What can you speak to that? It's not a matter of like, well, you shouldn't drink or you shouldn't abuse drugs. That's a bad choice. They're, again, about being understood. I think there's something about this community that people can't equate to the majority, which is the pressures that people are under and experiencing. Even though we like to think things are getting better, there's still a historical perspective, but that we know in any communities that people fall to drug abuse and alcohol if they're struggling with anxiety or trauma or, you know, sexual assaults and things. But in this community, it's almost aggravated a little bit more.
And we call that minority stress.
Okay.
Which is the stress that
so
people,
you have a word for it. This is why we have to talk.
The stress that LGBT people of color, women, that we carry with us because of our own experience as well as cultural experiences, social and cultural experiences with discrimination, violence, harassment, bullying. We carry these stresses with us when we go to see a new doctor, when we go back to see a doctor that might have been not the best experience in the past. That minority stress weighs on us. It, for some people, means that they don't seek care. It means that they delay or avoid care. And by the way, delaying care for something like a routine cancer screening might mean that cancer is not caught early enough. So delaying care can be very serious. And so this minority stress that we carry with us is a challenge. We also know that resiliency is a key factor, and that LGBT people have been resilient in the face of very challenging healthcare experiences for decades. That even in very dark times for LGBT healthcare in America, LGBT people have said, we're going to be our own healthcare activists. We're going to advocate for our own community. We're going to learn what the medical establishment and sometimes the government is not doing, and we're going to fix it. And that level of resiliency and healthcare activism is something we should be proud of and use as a model for the ways in which we can continue to survive and thrive as a community today.
Do you remember the video series that was out? It's probably been several years that people would film and say, it will get better. It will get better. We've seen the strides and the advancements that this community has really brought forth through the activism. What do you say to people out there who are listening who still feel like enough hasn't been done?
Well, first, I want to comment on the it gets better idea, yeah. Which was, for some of us, it was empowering. And for others, including myself, when we heard some of these videos, I rolled my eyes. I was like, I don't want to tell an LGBT teenager today that sometime in the next 10 to 20 years, it might get better for them. I want to make it better for them now. I don't want to make them wait through challenging experiences in their middle school or high school. I don't want them to have traumatic experiences accessing healthcare. Telling a teenager that it will get better sometime in the future is not leadership. Making it better today is leadership. Demanding that that school actually resolves the pervasive bullying is leadership. Challenging this notion that so-called boys will be boys and that's why bullying is okay. That, you know, challenging these pervasive presumptions, that's leadership. And so for me, I'm not comfortable saying, in, whether we're talking about healthcare or education or society more broadly, that it will get better in the future. I'm more comfortable saying we're going to do everything we can to make it right as soon as possible, starting with today, because that's what our community deserves.
It's fabulous. Adrian, can you tell us one more time about the book, when it might be available, how people can access that once it's published?
Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health will be published in January 2020 by PM Press, a radical independent publisher in San Francisco Bay Area. It's available through their website, pmpress.org, but also anywhere books are sold, from Barnes & Noble to your favorite independent bookstore, and even on Amazon and other national sites. And for folks who have questions about Bradbury Sullivan Center and our programs, that can be accessed at BradburySullivanCenter.org.
Adrian, thank you so much for being here. One thing we learned at the beginning of our conversation with Adrian is that he doesn't want just noise. He wants change. And you certainly demonstrated that through all of your works and through our conversation this evening. I thank you so much for coming on. It was very informative.
It's a pleasure to be here with all of you.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much, Neil Heaver, our producer, and especially to our listeners. Be your best with purpose and passion, and you will be a leader. Thank you so much, Adrian. We want to congratulate you on your upcoming book, and especially want to wish you the best in all of your endeavors as executive director of Bradbury Sullivan Center, and again on your book, Bodies and Barriers, Queer Activists on Health. Listeners, be your best with purpose and passion, and you will be a leader. Have a lovely tomorrow.